What is up, cyber and crypto homies? Today is October the 18th of 2024, and this is episode number 119 of the Cybersecurity and Cryptocurrency Podcast. I'm your host, Eric English. All the views and opinions in this podcast are solely my opinions and do not reflect the opinions of my employer. If you want to follow me on X, I'm at CyberCryptoGuy. I've been saying Twitter still forever. It's X now. I got to get used to it. All right, so there's quite a few things to run through today. I wanted to talk about some of the news around Dogecoin and Elon Musk and all that kind of fun stuff. What's going on there? It's pretty interesting. But then on the cybersecurity side of things, there's some more Spectre vulnerabilities that were uncovered, specifically for Linux, it looks like. Also going to talk a little bit about some more North Korean IT hackers that are infiltrating our workforce, apparently. And then we'll touch on Globe Life and their breach, as well as a Boston Children's Health ransomware attack. So lots to cover there. And then kind of non-news related, I wanted to talk about some... There's these tools out there that insurance companies, cyber insurance companies use, tools like BitSight and Security Scorecard, and there are plenty of others out there that do a similar thing. And it's interesting that these insurance carriers rely so heavily on these tools. The information that these tools uncover isn't exactly a hacker's, you know, dream. Sure, some of it could be somewhat sensitive, but from my experience and what I've seen that they're uncovering, it's a lot of certificate-related things, or they're looking at the some sort of headers, HTTP headers, things like that, or cookie settings, all of which are very, you know, I wouldn't say it's the most exploitable thing in the world. It's not like it's a 10.0 CVSS criticality of a vulnerability, right? These are small little misconfigurations, or hey, your certificate cipher is using, you know, a lesser algorithm or whatever it is, right? A lot of the things they're uncovering are just not very great. However, these companies give you a score based on this OSINT that they perform on your business. And it's just really arbitrary, and the information that they're gathering isn't exactly all that critical in most cases. Now, sure, there are some where there could be some sensitive vulnerabilities that they're finding, but the vast majority of what I've seen is it's just the dumbest things, but they rate it, they give it their own ratings too on criticality, which also drives me crazy. They don't follow CVSS in all cases, especially for like misconfigurations or what they think is a misconfiguration. So I've had quite the debate, I guess you could say, with some of these companies out there. I won't name any names necessarily, but I named a couple of examples. And what's troubling to me is that these companies, you know, as long as you have a subscription to them, right, you can see all of the vulnerabilities of whatever other company. So that to me, I mean, I realize you can go on Shodan and probably find the same stuff at some level, but this tool aggregates all of that information for you. As a hacker, it's kind of easy to just see it all in one place, right? But again, not all of it is very hackable or very sensitive, right? There are cases where it is, but regardless, I don't think that these companies should be allowing anybody with a subscription to see the vulnerabilities that they've uncovered about you. That to me is a risk. You know, from my perspective, if I was to log into one of these tools and I want to go look at one of my competitors, for example, and I want to go look at their score that they're given by these tools, I would look and I'd be able to see every single vulnerability that they're reporting on. So that to me is not okay. You should have to request that vulnerability data. Showing someone a score, I could care less, right? I don't care if you see what my score is, this quote unquote magical score they've got. But if you get to just see all of the vulnerability data with no interaction from that company, to me, that's a risk, because now you have vulnerability data of another organization, right? So now that's in your hands to do as you wish with, And that also opens up avenues of compromise. If, for example, you look up company ABC and you see that they've got a bunch of vulnerabilities and you download, you know, some sort of information about those vulnerabilities and you share it with someone else. Or let's say your account to one of these, you can call them, I guess, are they an OSINT company or a data aggregator? Not sure what you want to call it, but regardless, if your account gets compromised, then and you have a paid subscription to these services, then you can go and see vulnerability data from anybody and everybody that you want. That is where I have an issue with these tools, you know, not having any sort of approval mechanism where you can just go and look at anybody's vulnerabilities. Okay, cool. Yeah, great. To me, that's not okay. And I won't name names again, but some of the feedback that I got from these companies was less than stellar. But I was basically told that, you know, they're protecting the world and, you know, all the marketing mumbo jumbo that you probably don't want to hear, right? They had really no concept of what the actual risk was to our business. You know, and it's like, well, yes, you can go pull this data from Shodan or do your own OSINT. I get it. But, you know, you're just aggregating this data and sharing it with anybody and everybody that pays for it. Okay. All right. So, it is what it is. I just don't like that. And insurance companies rely heavily on these tools. And to me, that is just not a true picture of what your company's risks are. This is a snapshot of whatever OSINT, you know, they did on what they think that you own. Oftentimes you'll find in these reports, they'll have a bunch of domains or IP addresses or whatever it is that have no relation to you and your company. However, it's bringing down your magical score with these, and then you have to go and debate them about whether or not you own that IP address or whether or not you own that domain. So this is where it gets really hairy. And, you know, so they're oftentimes reporting false information. All that information is viewable by anybody with a subscription. It's just not great. But insurance carriers apparently feel like this is a great report card on your business without really digging into what's going on internally at your business, right? That is where you'll find the majority of the risks. That's where you'll find the juicy details, not some OSINT, you know, tool that you're using to do a surface scan on domains and IP addresses that you think that company owns. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox on that one. But some other news that we saw today and over the past week or so, the whole Spectre meltdown thing that happened, gosh, that's been 2018-ish? Something like that. Well, researchers are still finding more Spectre-related vulnerabilities. Spectre is the speculative execution, so your CPU basically tries to predict what you're going to do before you do it, and they're able to exploit that to exfiltrate data in some cases. Well, I don't know about y'all, but I've never heard of a data breach via Spectre attacks or meltdown. Either one. And a lot of these are CPU related issues where you either have to, well, in some cases, you have to replace the CPU with something newer. Some of it can be a firmware thing where they can flash new firmware to the CPU, which is great. However, that's not always the case, right? So I just find it funny that, you know, we point out these, you know, allegedly critical vulnerabilities. However, these have never been leveraged, you know, in any newsworthy, you know, cyber attacks. Cyber attacks are still phishing. That's how it all starts, with more than, 90% of all attacks are phishing, start with phishing. So these Spectre vulnerabilities are saying it's Linux related and all this other stuff. And I have to roll my eyes at a lot of this because, you know, really, what's the risk level of this, right? And oftentimes, too, you need physical access to the device. So that makes the attack that much harder. And I don't really know a whole lot about, foreign adversaries that are going to come fly to your city and physically put their hands on your servers or your workstations and run Spectre related hacks on your system. So when these come out, I just kind of roll my eyes, and most people aren't going to go replacing all their hardware just because of this vulnerability or vulnerabilities of this type. That's just really, it's illogical and, you know, not cost effective, I guess you could say, to just go out and replace everything, especially for something that it's not exactly trivial to exploit these. I'm sure in some cases there are some that are, sure. But again, it's a very targeted, very specific type of attack. So the bad guy would have to know that you have a certain model of CPU and, you know, you're running a certain version of Linux and all these things. Then they'd have to have physical access in some cases. And it's not like it's a remote code execution type of vulnerability, right? But here we are. We've got another Spectre-like attack, and it affects the fifth and sixth generation of Xeon processors for servers, along with AMD's Zen 1, Zen 1 Plus, and Zen 2. It also affects Intel 12th, 13th, and 14th chip generations for consumers. So, yeah, if you're super paranoid, then you might want to replace your CPU. In some cases, though, you can get a firmware update to also resolve this. All right, some other news about our friends in North Korea. Well, it seems like after that whole no before attempt, I guess you could call it, where a North Korean hacker decided to try to get a job at no before. Well, apparently this is happening a lot more than we realize. And especially with remote type jobs, seemingly the North Korean hackers are able to, you know, get a job at whatever company it is. And, you know, as long as they're remote, they can hide basically. And, you know, they can VPN to a certain area in the United States, make it look like they're in whatever city that they claim they are. And so this is pretty interesting. They're saying that, you know, the hackers are using what they call laptop farms to route traffic between their real location and the company through a U.S.-based point or endpoint, I guess you could say. So very, very scary to kind of see this type of thing. But also at the same time, you know, we've seen this happen with No before, and now it seems to be ramping up. So I guess, you know, be on the lookout here. If you have a remote workforce and you're in security, this is something to be very, very cautious of. The hard part here is figuring out that this is happening, right? So they may, you know, use AI in some cases to present themselves as a, you know, as a white male or something, right? An American, right? And be able to, you know, present that using some sort of fake identity too, potentially, to an employer and get a job. So if you're in the security department, this is going to be very difficult to detect and very difficult to, you know, avoid in some cases, especially, you know, if HR is hiring people, right? And they're not necessarily, the North Koreans aren't necessarily getting just IT related jobs. In some cases they are, but if they can just get a job at one of these companies, right, and get a company device and company VPN access, well, that can be a treasure trove for a hacker, right? So this is where you got to be very cautious about who you're hiring and where they are. And it's difficult because, you know, in the world of remote workforce, this is very, very challenging. I have seen instances where an employer will, even if you're remote, they will fly you in for a day just to verify who you are, especially like on your first day of employment. I've also seen instances where they will do a webcam-based recorded session, if you will, or meeting, whatever you want to call it, where you have to hold up like your driver's license, you know, next to your face on the video camera. And they also need copies of all that. You also have to hold up your social security card and other, you know, personally identifying documentation. In some case, they want to see like a bill with your name on it, your name and home address. So very difficult, though, for somebody that somehow gets past all of that. And maybe they use, you know, I guess you could call them surrogates in a way. They use, you know, actual people, actual U.S. citizens, and they pay them a bunch of money and say, hey, go get a job at this organization, you know, present yourself, you know, as you, and then when you get the company device, you tell us and we'll pay you, that kind of thing. So it's very interesting, and it makes you kind of wonder what the North Koreans are after. And you can only imagine it is sensitive, like government-related data, you would think. Or, I don't know, it could be a lot of different things, right? It just kind of depends. But it definitely makes you wonder, what are they after? What are they trying to exfiltrate, I guess, from these various organizations that they're getting these jobs at? So so in this article, they're mentioning in mid-2024 that SecureWorks did some investigations, and they had a whole bunch of proprietary data stolen basically right after an employee was hired. So yeah, pretty interesting. The data was transferred to a personal Google Drive using the company's virtual desktop infrastructure. So, you know, that kind of thing, as long as you've got the right firewalls in place or a CASB of some sort, or trying to think of other controls, or just block these cloud storage sites altogether, then you could have, you know, potentially detected and or prevented some of this. But with the right DLP controls on a CASB or a secure web gateway, or a good firewall with like always on VPN kind of thing, and you're doing SSL decryption and you can see all these things, then you could have potentially detected this type of attack. But also too, it looks like they're using AnyDesk for remote access. So AnyDesk seems to be the go-to remote access solution for hackers and scammers here lately. It used to be TeamViewer. Now it appears like AnyDesk is kind of the new latest and greatest tool for hackers and scammers to use. So if you're hiring, be on the lookout for this kind of a thing, and make sure that you can, you know, physically shake someone's hand. And even when they do that, you still got to be careful and have other, of course, layers and controls in place. All right, some other news about Globe Life. So apparently Globe Life got this random, I guess, maybe a phone call or email from a threat actor, my favorite word, two words, a threat actor who attempted to extort money in exchange for not publishing stolen data that they had allegedly stolen from Globe Life. So what's always interesting about these is seeing whether or not the company paid, or, you know, what happened, right? Was the data actually published? That's always kind of the end game here. So in this case, it looks like there were 5,000, it says at least 5,000 customers of its subsidiary. It's called American Income Life Insurance Company, are impacted. They do say that this number may increase as the investigation continues. They did say that the company's operations weren't disrupted. This wasn't like ransomware, apparently. But I guess they, you know, breached the company. Looks like it says through a web portal of some sort. And then from there pivoted and started stealing data. So very interesting there. They did not pay this, my lovely phrasing here, the threat actor. Why are they actors anyway? Are they really acting, or are they called hack? Can we just call them hackers? Can we go back to that? Is that such a bad word? It's got to be a threat actor. Oh yeah. Okay. So the threat actor is was trying to extort the money. Of course, they did not pay this magical threat actor. So good on them for not paying it. But it sucks that this data was stolen. And I know we've preached it a bazillion times before, but once again, freeze your credit at all three credit bureaus, and you know, you don't have to worry, right? This is why freezing your credit is so ridiculously important. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your kids, your wife, your what, whoever, everybody, tell them all to please go freeze your credit right now, today. If you haven't done it at all three, you can't just do it at one. You have to do it at all three credit bureaus to protect yourself. Even if one is left unfrozen, some credit providers will take just one. So if they can just pull a report from, let's say, just Equifax, because you forgot to freeze it there, well, they can still issue you a line of credit in some cases. Now, most require at least two of the credit bureaus to check your credit score with. So I guess that's a good thing, but not all of them do. So again, freeze your credit, protect yourself. This also goes back to the breach from a few weeks ago where all the social security numbers were leaked from that data mining company. And again, if your credit's frozen, you don't have to worry about any of this kind of stuff. Now, there are more than three credit bureaus. That's always the thing to think about here. How far do you want to go? Do you want to take it to the next level and go past the top three, the Equifax, TransUnion, TransUnion and Experian, and do you want to go further? If you do, there are a lot of different articles. Michael Basil is probably one of the best sites you can go to for learning how to freeze your credit at all of these bureaus. It's IntelTechniques.com. He's got a credit freeze page on his site where you can go, and it lists out all the instructions. It's got links, direct links to it. So it's extremely helpful. And I would highly recommend it. Again, based on your threat model, if you have your if you've already had your identity stolen, you may want to go beyond those top three credit bureaus, and you may want to freeze it at the other ones too. The smaller bureaus are typically used for, let's say you're getting a cell phone from Verizon or T-Mobile or somebody. Well, in a lot of cases, they'll check your credit before they give you that phone with that payment plan, right? But they're not checking your credit with Experian or Equifax or TransUnion. They're going to check your credit with these smaller credit bureaus. These other smaller ones are also typically used for getting utilities at your house. So like you don't have to always pay a deposit, like when you get electric service, like electricity provider or whatever. Oftentimes, if you're a brand new customer and you've never had electricity service before, they'll make you pay a deposit. But if you have a history and a good standing credit with these smaller credit bureaus, then you typically don't have to pay that deposit, right? So there are some other benefits there where that way that would prevent somebody from opening utilities in your name, or, you know, getting a cell phone, you know, using your credit, that kind of stuff. So it all depends on your threat model and just how far you want to take it. But when you do these, there's different ways to unlock your credit once you have it frozen. So just be aware of what that process is, because it can be very challenging at some of these, especially if you lose the, there's one, I think it's Check Systems, that they send you a piece of mail with a PIN number on it. And if you lose that, next time you need to unfreeze it, well, they make you wait 7 days for another parcel to come in through the mail with a new PIN number to unfreeze your credit. So just keep in mind, how do you unfreeze once it's already frozen? Make sure you've got all that kind of ready to go. So that way, if you, you know, applied for utilities somewhere and you get denied, you can be like, oh yeah, crap, I got to go unlock it at whichever credit bureau it is, right? All right, sorry, I got off on a little side tangent there. But moving on, there was yet another ransomware attack. This one is at, what's so terrible about these is some of the places that get ransomware. Boston Children's Health, man, just terrible, because this is a children's hospital. I mean, come on, man. But, you know, hackers have no mercy. They don't care, right? They're just trying to get paid. So basically, this Boston Children's Health Network, 300 pediatric physicians and over 60 locations in the New York Hudson Valley and Connecticut areas. So the Northeast, essentially. So it's unfortunate that this is happening, but, you know, they don't care who they target in some cases. Now, we have seen some ransomware gangs that they encrypted, you know, a place like this, and like, oh my gosh, we're so sorry, and they decrypted everything for them. But in this case, unfortunately, they did not care. So as part of this, you know, the new ransomware techniques are to exfil data as well. So there was some data exfilled current and former employees, patients, and guarantors. That data includes things like full name, social security number, addresses, date of birth, driver's license, medical records, health insurance information, billing information, and treatment information, although the treatment information was slightly limited. Regardless, this is just terrible to see, and you never want this to happen, especially to a children's health company like this. But anyway, the data looks like it's going to get leaked, because it does not appear that the Boston Children's Health is going to pay the ransom. So good for them for not paying. But now they have to try to recover, and that therein lies the problem, right? This is such a devastating thing to recover from, especially, you know, with 60 locations and 300 physicians. And you can imagine the supporting staff there is probably, you know, you're up over probably 2,000 employees, maybe more, across those 60 locations. So you can imagine if each of those has an individual workstation plus all the server infrastructure to support all those employees is encrypted, and now you have to go and remediate and fix all of that. So I feel the pain there, and just hope that you know, gets fixed sooner than later. They do also say in the article that they are going to offer, my favorite thing, credit monitoring for those who had their social security number and driver's licenses exposed. Again, folks, you don't need credit monitoring. Just freeze your credit. Credit monitoring requires you to leave your credit unfrozen. They will monitor, but fraudulent accounts can still be opened. That's where it's a problem. So just freeze it. Just avoid all that altogether. Unfreeze it when you need to open a new line. All right. So over to some crypto-related news. Man, Bitcoin's driving me crazy. I can't tell what the heck's going to happen. But we're up to 68,760 today all of a sudden. And it's like, wait a second. We were down at like 58 just a couple weeks ago. And it's up over $3,000 just today. And a week ago, we were at 62,000. Probably 2 weeks ago, around October 10th, we were at 58,000. So it's jumping back up, which is, I guess, great if you bought in when it went down to 58. Made a little bit of money there, hopefully. But it's just so hard to tell what the heck is going on with Bitcoin. But Ethereum's at 26.58, so that's pretty good as well. So other fun Elon Musk talk here. We all know that Elon loves his Dogecoin. Well, apparently Dogecoin jumped like 10% because of Mr. Elon Musk. All he has to do is say the word Dogecoin, and all of a sudden it goes through the roof. 10% is not through the roof, but 10% of where Dogecoin is at now is a pretty significant jump there. So all he has to do is say the word. Apparently, Elon was at a Trump convention or campaign in Pennsylvania somewhere and decided to tout the old Dogecoin. So everybody jumped on top of that, and boom! There it goes. All of a sudden, it just blows up and goes to the moon, as they say. But not quite to the moon, but hey, I mean, 10% is 10%, right? That we'll take it. Some kind of other interesting Elon Musk-related news. Quite a while ago, Tesla purchased a whole bunch of Bitcoin, allegedly $760 million worth of Bitcoin, which, holy smokes, is a lot. Well, apparently, the wallets associated with Tesla have moved $760 million worth of Bitcoin. He may have actually bought more than that. I need to check into that and see. But regardless, $760 million of Bitcoin is being moved around. They were moved to unknown Bitcoin wallets. Apparently, Tesla is the fourth biggest Bitcoin holder among public companies. I had no idea. That's pretty interesting stuff to see, too. I know MicroStrategy has a crap ton of Bitcoin. I forget what their number is, but they've also got a whole bunch, and they keep buying some, too. But oh, here we go. So Tesla bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin in February 2021. So they've taken about half of that and started moving it around for whatever reason. So we don't know what's happening there, why it's being moved, but of course that made the news rounds because, ooh, wow, $760 million is being moved here. Shooey, that's a lot of money. But, you know, when he bought in February 2021, Bitcoin was way lower. Wasn't it about, you know, 10 to 15,000, I want to say? Heck, it may have been more than that, but regardless, that was back in 2021. I can't remember that far back, but Bitcoin certainly wasn't worth anywhere near 60,000 or even 70,000 like we're approaching today. So pretty interesting to see. Makes you wonder, what is he going to do? Is he going to buy Dogecoin? That's all the speculation is, right? Tesla's now going to buy Dogecoin. Yeah, but who knows, right? It could be, they may just be moving it for security purposes, right? Putting it in some sort of, I hate how they call it offline storage. It's not really offline storage. Cold storage. Okay. Yeah, I guess you can call it cold storage. However, the Bitcoin is always online. So it's not really, you can't take your crypto out of the blockchain. It's always in the blockchain. If someone gets your private keys, you can still have your crypto stolen. So it may be that they're, you know, splitting this out to avoid if someone did get those private keys. Let's say someone gets a hold of a quantum computer and starts trying to crack these, which is seemingly very doable at this stage. I don't believe Bitcoin has quantum-resistant encryption yet. However, it's allegedly coming. But let's say someone, you know, got, well, I mean, heck, if you had a quantum computer, you could steal everybody's wallet, right? So maybe they're just trying to reduce the risk a little bit, though. In case one of those private keys gets leaked, they've got it, you know, separated out into 100 million here, 100 million there, whatever it is, just break it up a little bit with different wallets, with different private keys, store those keys in different places securely, right? And make sure you're not going to get all of your stuff stolen at once. All right, folks, I think that's it for today. Appreciate everybody listening, and we will talk again soon.